MacCast, Wednesday, June 24th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, recovering from vacation is always an interesting thing. I don't know if you're like me, but I prep and I plan ahead of time. I try and get work out of the way. I try and get things done, kind of clear my schedule so I can get off and just relax. And inevitably, when you get back, guess what? The work never goes away. Are you like this as well? It seems like you have more to do when you get back. So I have been playing catch up for a while now. And what that means for us, though, is we have a packed show to get into today. Lots of stuff going on, lots of stuff happening. Most specifically, I really wanted to drill in and get deep on a couple topics in the news that have been happening lately. One being this whole thing with Apple Music and the whole free streaming thing, you know, the thing with, oh, that musician, what's her name? Oh, yeah, you know that girl? I'm just kidding, Taylor Swift. You know, the whole thing with Taylor Swift was going on, so I wanted to dig into that, figure out what that was all about. Also, we had the story about the XARA, I guess we could call it. I don't know, XARA exploit that was going on. Wanted to get the details for you on that, so we have that in here. We're going to talk about Apple Watch sales and margins. Another thing that I wanted to dive into, of course, is what I'm excited about from WWDC. We haven't really talked since then, believe it or not. So I'm going to give you my opinions, or just let you know some of the things that I'm most excited about. Can you tell I'm a little bit excited about this episode? I think it's really, really great. Also wanted to dig into Apple Music from a perspective on just how is it going to work. A lot of you have questions surrounding that. So like I said, lots of content in here. It's going to be probably a long one. So strap in if you need to do it in two parts, three parts, four parts, whatever it might be. I totally understand. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen Pro 7. I am a user of PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro, have been for years. I really could not get through a week without those products. I use them with my clients. I use them personally, whether it's just needing to jump in and quickly, you know, browse through and just mark up the PDF with some notes and things like that, or whether it is getting in there to add a signature. That's probably the thing I use most, is getting in there, adding a signature, or taking a form that isn't a form and actually converting it into a real PDF form where I can actually fill the thing out, those fake forms. Anyway, PDF Pen 7 Pro is really the advanced version of PDF Pen, and it is just the ultimate all-purpose PDF editor from Smile. It does everything that PDF Pen does. So like I said, you can add signatures, you can edit text and images. It does the OCR. That's another key feature, is, you know, OCR on my PDF documents so that I can search them, I can find things that I'm looking for. PDF Pen will also export in Word format. And then with PDF Pen Pro, what you get on top of that is that ability, like I said, that I use all the time to create an interactive PDF form. It will also build a table of contents for you, which can be really handy if you have longer documents. You can set document permissions. That's another feature. I'll want to secure documents. If I'm going to send something out and I don't want prying eyes getting in there, I will secure it and then, you know, call the person on the other end, up on the other end, give them the password so they can get in there. Oh, and this is another great feature of PDF Pen Pro. I've used this a few times. Convert multi-page websites into a PDF, or a website into multi-page PDF. So if you have a really long scrolling website or something that you just want to read offline later, you can turn that into a PDF with PDF Pen Pro 7. So it adds all those great features and a whole lot more. Another great one is the ability to export in Microsoft Excel and PowerPoint formats. So you can do all that, and plus it syncs. You got to be able to take your documents with you wherever, and so you can sync with PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone via iCloud Drive, and it is really great. The only thing to know about PDF Pen Pro 7 is it does require Yosemite, but most of us are running Yosemite anyway. So I want you to check it out. Visit smilesoftware.com/Maccast now. You can actually download a free demo of PDF Pen Pro 7 and try it out today. But it's awesome. I'll just tell you that right up front. And I really want to thank Smile for being a long-term and continued sponsor of the Maccast. We love them. smilesoftware.com/Maccast. So let's get into this Apple Music thing. There was this big controversy because Apple is doing something. A lot of other music services, they have a free tier. Places like Spotify, things like that. Apple is not doing a free tier with their music service. So what they decided to do was a longer free trial period. So they're going to give everybody a 3-month free trial of Apple Music. And it came out that during that free trial period, Apple was not going to be paying artists for any streams that were happening on those free accounts. And that caused a little bit of uproar, specifically really with a lot of indie artists and things like that. But just artists in general were a little bit put off by that. Now, Apple, for their part, what they were going to do is pay a little bit higher rate once those people were converted to subscribers. They were going to pay a higher rate on that, and that was sort of how Apple felt the artists would recoup that recoup their that trial period, the money they didn't make during that trial period. Well, many artists likely have now Taylor Swift to thank, and a few other big name artists who spoke out for the fact that Apple came out and said they will be paying music artists for that free trial period. As a matter of fact, Taylor Swift wrote this open, what she called a love letter to Apple Music, and she was great in it. She was really complimentary of Apple and their relationship with artists and music and stuff like that, and was just saying, hey, we think you can do better. And within hours, Eddie Q responded on Twitter. Obviously, they were already sort of considering this, and it came out later that, yeah, they had been talking about it a few days before leading up to this, that maybe they needed to do something different. But he came out and said Apple Music will pay artists for streaming even during that free customer trial period. And so what I thought about immediately after that was, well, you know, Apple is not going to have ad support during that free trial. And that's how some of these other services or free services work, right? They offer free streaming in exchange for listening to ads. Apple's not going to have ads during that free trial. So the payouts would, the assumption is it's coming out of pocket from Apple. And they will not be able to, so they won't have revenue coming in to pay artists out of the paid, streaming subscribers. We're all going to get a free trial for 3 months. So we're not going to be paying Apple out of pocket. And so they're kind of betting that, you know, a certain number of people are going to convert, because typically the way the payouts work is it's based on how many paid subscribers you have, how many times your song gets streamed, you know, like there's this big pool. And we'll jump into that here in a second. But once Apple announced, hey, we're going to pay for free streaming, a lot of people were saying, well, how are you going to do that? And Apple was asked what the payout rate for rights holders were going to be during the free trial period, because typically that's a lower rate than the actual rate that they'd be paying out for paid subscribers. And we already knew that rate. And Apple declined to comment. But according to the New York Times, they cited some music executive sources who said the payout rate for the free trial streams is going to be about 2 cents for each song streamed, which I guess is reportedly comparable to the rates that are paid by other services that have a free streaming tier option. So seems pretty typical. There's also going to be a smaller amount, I guess, that is going to be paid for the songwriting rights. So that's separate from that 2 cents. And supposedly that amount is kind of still in negotiation. So we don't really know what that is going to be. But they're saying the typical trial period payout is going to be about half the standard rate payout. So because we know Apple is paying just over 70%, most sources are guessing that Apple's going to pay out about 35.7% of, you know, revenues. And again, I don't know how they're figuring out what those revenues are for those free streams or during that free trial period, which again lasts, 3 months. So it's a pretty significant free trial. And so that's brought up a lot of debate about streaming services again, and, is the value there compared to just selling music and stuff like that. And here's the thing. We all know that, and all artists know, that streaming revenues stink compared to revenues for song and album sales. But you have to remember, and because Apple's being called to task on this whole streaming rates thing, Apple fought for years, Steve Jobs fought for years, saying people want to buy music, they want to own their music. That didn't win. That's just the way the world goes, right? We got to a point where consumers said streaming is what we want and this is how we want to do it. And just to give some perspective, Spotify claimed in 2014, just perspective on how different this is in terms of the payout. Spotify claimed in 2014 that Taylor Swift's label received about $2 million in payouts for streaming globally. Now, the label claimed domestically here in the U.S., they got about $500,000, okay? With streaming rights holders, and in most cases, you know, this is the labels unless you're an indie self-published artist and you have some other deal. In most cases for streaming, what artists are getting is about 6/1000ths to 8/1000ths of a cent per stream. So a very, very small amount. Now, in Spotify's case, these numbers came directly from Spotify, and I think it takes into account both their free tier and their paid tier. So they call this sort of the effective rate that's paid out. So the artists are making more per stream actually on those paid tiers. The thing is that Spotify's free tier represents just about 75% of their membership. Now, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Apple Music, because Apple Music in the long term doesn't really have a free tier beyond the 3-month free trial. So it's all going to come down to the number of paid subscribers that Apple Music has that sort of determines how much they're doing in terms of payouts. But really what I wanted to get to was the perspective here that, you know, Spotify is claiming in 2014 that they paid Swift's label $2 million globally for all of the streaming that her music, you know, did on Spotify's network. Put that in comparison to her album 1989, which grossed $12 million in sales the first week it went on sale. And that kind of gives you perspective on how much more valuable selling music and selling albums is versus doing the streaming thing. And this is a huge big name artist. Now, of course, you know, I don't want to discount the fact that none of this takes into account the possible benefits that streaming has on discovery of new music, and that can potentially lead to sales, which is going to generate higher revenue. It also doesn't take into account, you know, fans finding new music and then going to concerts and buying merchandise. All of those things aren't accounted for in this. So you got to take all of these numbers with a grain of salt. But I think another point that's not being clearly made is that the approximately 70% payout that streaming services are paying out goes to the rights holders and not necessarily directly to the artists in most cases. So the articles that say, you know, streaming services are paying out 70% to the artist, that's not correct. They're paying it to the rights holders, which is usually the labels, and then there's a deal that the artist has with the labels, and then the payouts get divvied up from there. So it's really hard to tell exactly how much money is going direct when you buy a song directly to your favorite artist, and it varies from artist to artist and things like that. So this is a very complicated, funky industry. But the ultimate thing that I want to get to is the cat's out of the bag, and it's not going back in. This is how people want music. This is how we're going to be selling music. And artists are going to have to adapt and, you know, get into this sort of new way. And we've been through this many, many times before. Remember when, you know, iTunes came out and started selling, you know, per track or per song, and artists absolutely hated it. And I'm thinking a lot of them now are looking at the streaming thing thinking, hey, we should go back to, can we go back to that model? You know, and not all of them are in this group. I'm generalizing here, but you get the point, right? The times are changed and you have to adapt to your market. And the reason this sort of came up for me is I had a Twitter exchange with someone who claimed that, you know, how would developers feel if Apple started doing a $9.99 a month subscription, all you can eat app downloads? And I guess my argument back would be, you know, yeah, they're not going to like it, but if that's the way consumers decide that they want to buy software, that might be the new method. You know, I don't think a lot of software developers liked moving from selling software, what I call sort of the big box way, you know, the boxed copy way, and moving into this new app store model, where they're having to compete, they've had to adjust prices, they're having to do things and sell software a lot differently than they did, say, 10 years ago. And I see this as sort of the same sort of adapting that the music industry had to do when moving from album sales to per track sales, you know. And it sucked, but guess what? They're adapting and they're finding ways to make money. And some developers are making more money, some are making less, but you sort of have to figure it out. I also thought that, you know, this argument about would developers like a monthly subscription model for software is actually really happening if you look and consider Microsoft and Adobe's new models. And this is specifically just one software company or, you know, one manufacturer's products. It's not everything on the App Store. But how far are we away from having an App Store where you pay a subscription and you subscribe and consume all of your software for one price? Again, I can, with my Adobe Creative Cloud subscription, I have access to everything in Adobe's library, and I'm paying a little bit less per month than I would if I had bought each of those things individually. Some of it I don't use, some of it I do, and I guess you have to determine the value that comes into play there. And, you know, music is happening. But the point is, there's still a lot of money to be made in music. In a recent Billboard piece I was reading, Terry Maddox, who's the CEO of CD Baby, laid out some recent calculations. And, you know, Apple Music is looking to be a pretty big boon in this new economy for musicians. He says, you know, there's 500 million iPhones out there. There's 300 million iPods already sold. And I'm just going to point out right up front, I think this number is a bit off because that's the total number of devices that Apple has sold ever as of June 2014. So you have to count some of those iPhones probably aren't in service anymore. A lot of the iPods probably aren't being used anymore. But and it also didn't account for iPads, you know, which you can listen to Apple Music on your iPad. So we've got to, you know, adjust the numbers here. But the point was, he was saying that if just 5% of those customers stay on past the trial subscription and go for the iTunes Music subscription at $9.99 a month, that's going to generate $4.8 billion in gross revenue for Apple Music. Now, to put that in perspective, Spotify's 2014 gross revenue was estimated at $1.2 billion. So you're looking at almost four times. So even if you cut that in half, so even if you assume that Tracy's numbers are off by half, Apple Music right out of the gate could start generating about double the revenue that Spotify is generating. And Apple is still going to pay those partners, remember, slightly higher than industry average rate of 71.5% in the U.S. and about 73% outside the U.S. Of that revenue is going to be going to the music rights holders. And then you get the bonus of exposure and the tools that Apple's going to be providing with the Connect program for connecting with fans. And that provides a potential marketing opportunity to boost live shows, merchandise, all those sorts of things. So artists connecting with their fans is going to help them sell more music and t-shirts and all sorts of things. So I think ultimately this is a really good thing. And the last thing that happened this week surrounding this Apple Music thing is that by reversing course on this decision to not pay artists for the free trial period, Apple's already seeing payoffs. So this is a good thing for Apple. Again, really glad that Taylor Swift spoke up. I think a lot of us are. We want to see our favorite artists get paid for music. And so Apple Music has already now signed two of the major indie music rights holders, Beggars Group and Merlin Network. They represent about 20,000 indie labels and distributors, according to a report on Billboard. And so that means we're going to get a lot more indie music in the Apple Music subscription platform. And that's a really good thing because those guys were one of the big groups that was actually holding out. And now I guess Apple Music has also been endorsed by the independent music advocacy group, Worldwide Independent Network. So they're getting some accolades, they're getting some recognition for actually reversing this policy. And I think it's going to be good in the long term for getting more of our favorite music on Apple Music, because that's really what you want in a subscription service. You want to be able to go there and know that the music that you want to find and you want to listen to is going to be there. And it's also going to help for discovery. So we're going to get into, you know, what Apple Music is all about and what's in there and how you're going to subscribe to it and all that stuff later in the show. But I wanted to hit this right at the top of the show because it was sort of a big news thing that happened this week. Remember all those funky Apple vans that had been being spotted in places like Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, Phoenix, San Francisco, and a bunch of other areas? Those funky things with the cameras and the sensors and stuff like that. Apple has finally admitted that, yes, these are our vans, and they're actually being used for mapping data. As a matter of fact, they put up a support article on their website that actually details which cities the vans are going to be roaming around in and when. So some people are already, you know, planning to do the whole Google Maps thing and show up in strange costumes on streets and stuff like that and try and, you know, get a little exposure in Apple Maps. And they did confirm that the vans are collecting images along with other data. They haven't said specifically what that's going to be used for. They didn't flat out say, yeah, we're going to do Street View and we're going to bring it to Apple Maps. But they do say in the support article, we will blur faces and license plates on collected images prior to publication. So if they're not going to publish them for a Street View, I don't know what else they would be using them for. So I'm pretty sure we're going to be getting Street View on Apple Maps at some time in the future. The other thing that Apple is now doing, apparently, is they're actually branding the sides of the vans with Apple imaging. So when you see one, you're definitely going to know it's in service to Apple for their mapping efforts. And what's really going on is most people believe Apple's working behind the scenes more and more to bring their own data into Apple Maps rather than relying on third parties, so they can get more accurate information, probably more up-to-date information. And, you know, over the past few years, Apple has acquired numerous companies and technologies that are focused on cartography and mapping and stuff like that. And so this is just going to help bolster and improve and make that stuff better. There's also speculation that Apple's been taking photos of businesses and storefronts and other points of interest, possibly to replace some of the Yelp data and other third-party data, so that when you actually go into a location and you're looking at specific information about a point of interest, that Apple will be supplying its own data for that. And I expect that to happen as well. I would hope that Apple is going to supplement and enhance the data from the third-party sources. I think having the aggregate data is much more valuable and tends to be more accurate than just doing your own thing. But time will tell on that. And we've also seen hints that Apple has some sort of indoor mapping effort. Most specifically, it was sort of highlighted, in my opinion, at WWDC when Apple talked about transit directions in maps and the fact that they mapped out the underground transit stations so that as you're getting walking directions, they can direct you to the closest entrance, the best entrance, and can also estimate, hey, if I go in at this entrance and I have to catch my train and it's across the station, we know how far that is, so I can better estimate your time of arrival in those walking directions. And obviously, they've had to map out those locations, those indoor locations, to be able to deliver that information. So I have a feeling over this next year and moving into 2016 that we're going to see Apple Maps just getting better and better and better. And you know, frankly, I used Google Maps recently to do some driving directions. And, you know, I think they still have a little bit of a leg up on Apple. Specifically, what was great is their turn by turn would actually tell me which lane I needed to be in before I was getting up to an interchange or something like that. And I found that really, really handy. A feature I really hope that Apple copies and brings over to Apple Maps. But should be seeing Apple Maps improving very quickly and very soon. And I think Apple's already done a great job doing that so far. Let's talk about Apple Watch and specifically Apple Watch API. We know coming out of WWDC, we've got native apps coming. Personally, I cannot wait for native third-party apps on Apple Watch. I think, you know, I've really tried to get into the whole apps on Apple Watch thing in their current form factor. I hate them. For the most part, they stink. If they're not the native apps, I get what the FOD, which I'm calling the flower of death, the little, you know, flower where that's all you see and then the app never launches. I constantly get that with a number of apps. I'm generalizing here. There's some apps that work okay, but it's going to get so much better when we have native apps. And developers are getting excited about it too, because they're going to get access to things like the speaker, the mic, the digital crown, the heart rate sensor, the Taptic engine. It's going to be really interesting to see what they do with all that stuff. They're not going to have direct Bluetooth access, though. And that's still going to need to proxy through the phone. So there are some things that devs are speaking out for and saying, hey, we want a little bit more than you're going to give us. And, you know, Apple's going to do just like they did with the iPhone. I think they're going to roll this stuff out slowly. It's going to be very controlled. So we have one level this round, and next year they'll get feedback and they'll talk to developers and they'll see what else is going. But they're also, you know, talking a little bit about the fact that some of their access is kind of limited. So yeah, we have access to the digital crown, but you can really only use it for zooming and scrolling. You're not allowed to build in, you know, to commandeer it as a custom control, say, for something like a game, to do something that's not just sort of built in to the general or the main UI and things like that. Also, things like glances aren't getting the ability to add buttons. So if you've ever looked at glances, Apple's glances are the only ones that have actual buttons. If it's a third-party glance, you're typically tapping on something and it's jumping in or launching the full application, and then you get all your buttons and controls in there. Glance is really just informational at this point. So some people are hoping that, you know, Apple's going to add in stuff that's going to allow them to do more on the device autonomously. But really, we're probably going to need new hardware with that, and battery could ultimately be an issue. So I get that, you know, developers want access to things like being able to use the Wi-Fi connectivity or the Bluetooth connectivity. But, you know, to really become an autonomous device like an iPhone, you're going to need to have cellular in there. You're going to have Wi-Fi, GPS capabilities. And, you know, what does that do to battery life? How is that all going to work? How are you going to manage that? So there's a lot of questions I think that Apple needs to answer before they can start throwing that stuff in. Of course, a number of developers would also like a wider range of sensors, specifically for fitness applications, but for other applications as well. So imagine like a humidity sensor could be something that could be really, really handy. But regardless, you know, with the watch that we have now, there are still some great things coming with Watch OS 2. And I think some of those things are going to bring some autonomy and a lot of new features. A big one that's being talked about is the ability to connect to known Wi-Fi networks independently. So if you do leave your phone at home, if you go into an area where you've been before with your phone and the watch knows about the Wi-Fi network and it's open and has access, it can log in or connect to that and start downloading updates and information to apps that support that. You're going to get third-party complications, and those complications are going to actually be able to be pushed information. So think about live updates like sports scores. So if you have a little sports complication, it can automatically update as you're walking around. Time travel, I'm not so sure how useful that's going to be, but I guess the ability to see upcoming weather and calendar events, it's a good place to start. And you've got the nightstand mode in there and new watch faces. So there's some really good, exciting things coming in Apple Watch 2. And I'm excited to see what developers do with it and look forward to the release in the fall. As far as new hardware stuff, we talked a little bit about some of the things people are wanting. Something that we're hearing about in the rumor mill, which I'm not putting a lot of stock in at this point, but some folks are saying that Apple is looking at putting a FaceTime camera into the Apple Watch. And let's be honest, it's not going to be a FaceTime camera. It's going to be a selfie camera, right? I think there's not a lot of room to get it in there. I don't know how you're going to fit it in there without making the watch bigger. If you put it up towards the edge of the bezel, you're going to have weird distortions because you've got curved glass there. I just really don't see them making it work. And the quality of that sensor is probably going to be relatively low. I think, you know, Samsung tried this in some of their watches and it really didn't take off. And you've already got a great, you know, as long as you're going to have it tethered to your phone, you've already got a really great camera in your pocket. So I don't see the advantage. I guess maybe doing FaceTime video calls, but what's that going to do to bandwidth and battery life? There's just a lot of questions to be answered. As far as actual new features that I think will come in the next generation Apple Watch that we're hearing about that might make sense, a new Wi-Fi chip that could enable some tracking and location features like using Wi-Fi hotspot triangulation, so not a GPS, but the ability to hone in using Wi-Fi hotspots. And that may be key to one of the features Apple showed off at WWDC, which is Find My Watch. Apple is targeting similar battery life, so we expect that to stay the same. Also, there might be potentially some additional models. It's sounding like in the range between the stainless steel at $1,100 and the gold edition. And we heard, you know, prior to the release of the Apple Watch that Apple was looking at different materials and things like that beyond the stainless steel. So maybe something in titanium, those sorts of things. Expect that possibly in some new models showing up with the next version. And as far as when we will see the launch of a version 2 Apple Watch, sources right now are saying sometime in 2016. We don't have any more specific details than that. If Apple sticks along the release cycle of this Apple Watch, I would expect that would be sometime in the end of the first quarter, early second quarter, something like that. Did you read about this XARA, or what I'm calling Zara exploit, security issue that cropped up for macOS 10 and iOS this week and get a little bit nervous? I certainly did. I mean, it was being reported on as a really big deal, and I think it is a big deal, but something I wanted to make sure that I did on this show was really dig in and sort of explain what this thing is and why or why not, why we may or may not need to be worried, actually. And in case you didn't hear the story, what it is Indiana University released details on 4 security vulnerabilities they discovered in macOS 10 and iOS. And collectively, they're labeling these exploits or these attacks as cross-app resource attacks, or XARA, Zara. And as always, you know, the folks over at iMore did what I think is the best job of sort of laying everything out. So a lot of what I learned from them. So I'm going to summarize it for you as best as I understand it. But if you want all the nitty gritty and details, I will have a link to their section in the show notes at maccast.com. Head there, check it out, because it really is good stuff. But basically, all of these attacks rely on, and this is the first thing you need to know, rely on a malicious piece of software being installed on your Mac and iOS device, and then presenting itself, in essence, to the system as a different app. It sort of masquerades or hides itself in different ways and pretends to be another app, and in doing so, kind of tricks the system. And it's at that point when the malicious app can potentially intercept secure information that might be intended for, you know, a different application. It's a man in the middle, what they call a man in the middle style attack. So it kind of sits there, it waits for these messages to come in, and then reacts to them. And you are blissfully unaware that anything is really happening, or that your data has been compromised, or things have been stolen, or anything like that. And like I said, there's 4 ways that it can do this. 4 of them can potentially impact and run on OS X. Only one of them is also able to sort of exploit and take advantage of an issue on iOS. So on OS X, Zara targets the keychain database where credentials are stored and exchanged, WebSockets, which is a communication channel between apps and associated services, and bundle IDs, which uniquely identify sandbox applications and can be used to access their data containers, their target data containers. And then on iOS, Zara targets URL schemes, which are used to move people and data between applications. So kind of that thing that gets around sandboxing. If you've ever been in one app and then, you know, used a login from another app to log into that app, you know, sort of spins you around. A lot of times they're using URL schemes for that. And so if you're looking at these things, you know, between OS X and iOS, the exposure on iOS seems a bit more limited because of how the software is built. It doesn't have all the same features and functionality as OS X on the desktop, so it lacks some of these attack points for these various exploits. And so I think the real trouble, or what really concerned me about these exploits, is the researchers were actually able to get their apps that contained the malicious code, the exploits, into both the Mac and the iOS app stores. Now, they aren't there now, as far as I know, so you're not likely to download them by mistake. And I think Apple's already taken some measures on the back end to kind of deal with some of this stuff. So Apple's on top of it. And that's another thing you need to understand. We'll be talking more about that as we get through this. But I wanted to, again, break down these 4 attacks in layman's terms so you can hopefully better understand them. And I'm going to be totally oversimplifying here. And if you want those gory details, you know, check out that iMore link. But starting with the malicious OS X keychain entries. And what happens here is when you have an app installed, it only has access, if it's using the keychain, to read and write its own entries. But the problem the researchers discovered is that there is a flaw in something called the access control lists in OS X, which are used by the keychain to kind of determine, you know, what apps have access to those keychain entries. And what they found out is while the malicious app can't write to an existing keychain, what it can do is it can delete any keychain and then insert itself as the entry for another app and then start collecting any information, any new entries that come in from that app. So what happens is your legitimate app sort of sees the malicious app's inserted keychain and starts, you know, loading information into that. So if you're storing your password, it's now in that keychain. And once it's in there, both applications are registered for that keychain item, and they're essentially sharing it. So they both have access to it from that point forward. So that's the malicious keychain entry. The next thing is the what's called the WebSockets. And this is something that's used for communication between your browser and other OS X applications. And this is actually the one that these researchers were working with the folks over at 1Password. They notified 1Password because there's a potential attack vector there. But it's because 1Password has a browser extension that it uses to communicate with a little mini helper application. Because as a security measure, web extensions running in your browser cannot have direct access to app data. So there's this little helper application that sits between your web browser extension and the 1Password application. It's called 1Password Mini. And it uses this WebSocket communication to do what it needs to do. So the issue with this attack is that any app can connect to any arbitrary WebSocket port. It essentially sets up a little web port, a port for itself, and starts responding to requests. So assuming the port is available, it can set itself up, and any app can actually do this. So what happens is if the malicious app is there and sets up the port that 1Password Mini plans to use, guess what? It will do that, because if it finds that port is already set up and already there and it thinks it's 1Password Mini, it, boom, will start collecting that information. And so the key here is that you'd have to install and run the malicious app software while the other software that would use that port is not running or hasn't been installed. So whichever app sort of gets there first has the legitimate claim to that WebSocket port. So the malicious app would obviously have to know what port other applications were using and kind of have to target that specific app to actually do its thing. And as a matter of fact, the folks at 1Password have said, you know, a pretty good way to protect yourself for now until Apple actually patches things up is to make sure that you go into your 1Password settings and use the option to always keep 1Password Mini running. And you'll find that in preferences in general. And they also recommend that you keep using the 1Password browser extension because the browser extension actually has some security checks in place that will warn you if it thinks anything is going wrong. So if you're already using 1Password, you're going to be pretty well protected, especially if you just make sure you're always running the 1Password Mini helper application, because as long as that's running and has registered that WebSocket port, no one else can get at that. The third way on OS X that this exploit works is something called bundle IDs or sandboxes. And sandboxes are things, they limit an app's access to its own data. So in OS X, this is done using the unique bundle ID. It's a unique identifier per application, and it's used to create and control access to that application's data directory. Each application gets a data directory, and it only has access to that data directory. No other apps do. That's kind of that sandboxing. And where the flaw that enabled the attack in the case of bundle IDs came into play is not with the app's bundle ID, but with the IDs of helper applications that might be in the application's package. Those things, it turns out, could be spoofed, and this is what the researchers found. The trouble is that if your OS sees a container directory that already exists when it's trying to register a helper application or a bundle application. Again, it assumes it's already been set up, and it just registers itself to that container. And then that propagate. I think that kind of propagates up. So when you run a malicious app that contains a helper bundle that's pretending to be the helper bundle for a different application, and it sees that there, then it gains access to the target application's storage container and anything in it. And the researchers were able to kind of perpetrate this with Evernote, right? They set up this app that pretended to have an Evernote helper application. It registered itself into Evernote, and suddenly they had access to all the Evernote documents and things like that. So those are the three that are on OS X. Now, the fourth one is the URL scheme hijacking. And this is the only Xara exploit that impacts iOS. And it involves basically registering custom URL schemes that, when they're seen by the OS, tell specific applications to respond. So again, you could register something like Yelp:// and then any URL. You know, you can even try this when you're in mobile Safari. You know, if you know some of these applications that are using these helper URL schemes, you can type them in and you'll notice it'll go and it'll launch the application. And the trouble is that multiple apps can register the same URL scheme. So on iOS, what happens is the last application to register the URL scheme is the one that gets called. On OS X, the first application to register the URL scheme is the one that gets called. So you can probably already see what the problem is that if you install a malicious application on iOS and it registers the Yelp:// scheme, for example, it will be the app that's called when it sees that URL. And if you're passing sensitive data on that URL, something that you're not supposed to do if you're following best security practices, but unfortunately apps do this all the time, they might pass an OAuth key or some other sensitive token to that URL. Well, now the malicious app is responding to that first, and it's getting that information, and it could potentially use those keys to then sign on and do other sorts of malicious things. So that's not going to be good for you, and that's how this exploit is sort of perpetrated. And even worse, the malicious application, if it's smart enough, it can pass along that request back to the site that it was trying to connect with, so over to Yelp or something like that, and then the response comes back to the actual legitimate app on your device. So you don't even know that anything bad happened or that you got sort of man in the middle attacked. So that's what's been going on here. Now, Apple has been working with these researchers for the past 6 months. They've made several attempts to patch holes, but I guess they just couldn't finish in time. The researchers had said, you know, we're going to give you 6 months to kind of get things in order before we bring this out. And so Apple is working on it. They're aware of the problem. They've already actually implemented, as I said, some server-side security updates that secures the app data and blocks apps with sandbox configuration issues from the Mac App Store. So these, you know, presumably these apps aren't going to be able to actually get in the Mac App Store. And that was where my biggest concern was, because we pretty much trust that an app from the Mac App Store isn't going to do anything bad. And the fact that the researchers could get these in here was a little bit concerning. But they're also working to fix the other issues that are outlined by the researchers. And so I think ultimately, you know, this is going to get fixed up and we'll all be better protected for it. But in the meantime, if you're really still worried about this, the advice is the same advice we always give. Don't download software from developers you don't know or trust. And I know that's kind of a hard thing to say, but, you know, ask around. If something seems shady, if something seems weird, or, you know, just looks weird, just give yourself pause, at least until this thing is patched up. And, you know, I think ultimately then we'll be okay. If you have more questions about this, again, check out that iMore article or just shoot me an email, matthess@gmail.com, and I'll try to do my best. You know, again, this is just my understanding, my processing all this, and hopefully I got most of it right. Like I said, I spent a lot of time researching this stuff, so I think I did. It's the best I could do for now. And if I missed anything, or if you work in security, you're a security expert, and I got something a little bit off, please shoot me an email or an audio comment. Help us sort of clarify things so that we all know what's going on and can keep ourselves better protected. Want to talk about Apple Watch sales? I know, you know, numbers, they're always good. But, you know, things are looking actually pretty good for Apple Watch sales. Reporting on the latest data from Slice Intelligence, Reuters says that they've calculated that Apple has likely sold about 2.79 million Apple Watches since April. Now, how Slice is actually coming to this figure was called into question by John Gruber and others. So we're taking this number with a grain of salt, but it's still clear that Apple is set to have a pretty large slice of the smartwatch market. Plus, there were some other interesting numbers from this study. They also determined that about 17% of customers were also purchasing a band or additional bands from Apple to go along with their Apple Watch. And as far as margins go, it's looking like the bands. This really didn't come as a surprise to me, but it's looking like the bands have a pretty significant margin. IHS estimated that the 38-millimeter fluoroelastomer band cost Apple about $2.05 to make. You know, remember, this is a band that they sell for $50 US. Tim Cook has actually come out publicly and said, you know, these cost estimates, these supply estimates are wildly inaccurate, and I would tend to agree with that. I mean, they leave out things like design, development, manufacturing, tooling, spinning up production, machining, labor, packaging, shipping, marketing. I mean, you can see there's a lot of things that go into developing these products that are beyond just the cost of the stuff that goes into making it, right? But even still, with a $50, you know, retail price and $2 worth of materials, you can see Apple's making a good penny. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we want Apple to have good profit margins. You know, that's good news for us. It's good news for Apple. It's good news for the bottom line. And if customers are willing and able to pay the price that's being asked, that's sort of how our economy works, right? Apple should be able to get as much money as people are willing to pay for these bands. So I see no problem with that. It's just an interesting number that came out this week. But getting back to this number, this 2.79 million watches sold number, I find this amazing because if you go back and you look at 2014, companies shipped a total of 6.8 million smartwatches in 2014, according to numbers from the Smartwatch Group. Breaking that down, that's 1.2 million for Samsung, about 700,000 for Pebble, 600,000 for Fitbit, which I guess they have a smartwatch or a fitness band with a watch-like capabilities called the Charge, and about 500,000 units for Lenovo Motorola. And the average sale price on their watches was $189 US. So 6.8 million smartwatches, 1.2 million for Samsung. At almost 3 million, Apple's almost doubling what Samsung was. But more importantly, their price is almost double the average sale price. The lowest priced Apple Watch is $349. So their lowest one is almost double that. And they have a whole range, and they're making. You know, they have many at much higher price points that are bringing in even more money. So I fully expect at their next conference call that we're going to see some really astounding numbers from Apple Watch. And we would if they actually broke out those sales figures. It's going to be really hard. We're going to have to kind of extrapolate because Apple did this thing. Apple Watch is going to fall into this category called other, which means it's going to be lumped in with Apple TV, with Beats headphones, with accessories, and I think even iPods. So we're not going to really be able to determine that number, but it's going to be significant. The thing is that I believe why Apple lumps all this stuff together is because while that sounds amazing, you know, 3 million smartwatches, it's just a drop in the bucket when you compare those sales to a juggernaut like the iPhone or iPad. Morgan Stanley is actually predicting that in this June quarter, Apple iPhone sales will be around 53 million units. So 50 million units more than the little Apple Watch. But needless to say, Apple Watch is going to be a significant part of Apple's lineup for a while, and I only expect it to grow a bit more. The whole, you know, smartwatch sector is actually growing pretty rapidly. It's gonna be interesting to see how smartwatches and wearables and things like that pan out in the long term. You know, is this gonna be a passing fad? Is it gonna be something we're gonna have with us for a few years and it's gonna continue to grow? I think nobody really knows right now, but what is clear is that Apple is going to be a big player in that sector as long as it's around. If you own a 27-inch iMac with a 3 terabyte hard drive sold between December 2012 and September 2013, you might actually be eligible for a replacement hard drive. I'm going to have a link to the program, the Apple support page, in the show notes at maccast.com. But Apple has determined that a very small number of 3 terabyte hard drives in the 27-inch iMacs will potentially fail under certain conditions. And because of that, they've issued a repair program to cover that. So they set up this page on their website. You can actually check your serial number there to see if your machine is eligible. If you don't know how to find your serial number, you just go under the Apple menu and choose About This Mac, and you will find it there. And then if you do determine that your machine is impacted, the recommendation is that you back up your machine, use hard drive or some cloning software or any other backup software, make a full backup of it because you're likely not getting that data back or that drive back. They're going to replace it. Set up a Genius Bar appointment or call an Apple-authorized repair center or contact AppleCare to arrange for your service. And then, get it in there and they'll replace it, and hopefully you'll have your Mac back fairly quickly. If you actually already did a hard drive replacement of a 3 terabyte drive, you may also be eligible for a refund. So even if you've already gone through a repair, contact Apple anyway, just to see if you're eligible to get some money back. And the hard drive replacement program is going to expire on December 19th, 2015, or 3 years after the date of sale of your iMac. So whichever of those I think comes first is what happens. So get it in now, if you think or suspect that you have a problem. And again, this is just 27-inch iMacs with 3 terabyte hard drives sold between December 2012 and September 2013. So if you fall into that, check out the link in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, a few shows back, I think it was, I talked about passwords and how to create a better or more secure passwords. And right after that episode, I received feedback from a listener who pointed out that there was this great website, because one of the things we talked about in there was this great comic from XKCD that talked about, you know, creating a password that is human readable, easy to remember, but very hard for a computer to guess, versus what we kind of do now, which is create these really hard to remember passwords that computers can actually crack pretty easily. And so it was based on this comic, and what he pointed out was that there's this great website called xkpasswd.net that will help you and assist you in creating a XKCD style password. Well, it's actually run by my friend Bart Bouchatz. I'm occasionally on the Let's Talk Mac show that he does monthly, and I figured rather than, you know, just me talking about the service and what it is, maybe we should just go straight to the horse's mouth and talk to Bart. So that's exactly what I did. Hey, Bart, how's it going?
Not too bad at all, Adam.
Yeah, thanks for coming on to talk about passwords with us.
My absolute pleasure. It's something, for some strange reason, it's something I get excited about.
So I've already talked about the fact that, you know, last show I was talking about passwords and setting up a secure password, and the whole XKCD, is that right?
XKCD is the webcomic.
Yeah, XKCD comic thing came up where they talk about, you know, this idea of why do we have this concept of, you know, telling people to pick passwords that are hard for them to remember, but, you know, easy for a computer to crack, versus the flip side of things. And of course, I'm oversimplifying the comic, and if people want to see the comic, I'll link to it again in the show notes so they can check out what's going on there. But what happened after almost immediately after I aired that episode, is somebody emailed me and said, hey, you know, Bart has this tool called XK Password, or XKPASSWD.net, where, you know, you can use and you should probably describe it. I was going to describe it to people. So why don't you describe it? It's based off of this comic, right?
It's based off of this comic and something else. So basically, there were two things that happened within a few weeks of each other way back when, a couple of years ago. So there was the XKCD comic came out with the Correct Horse Battery Staple comic.
Right.
And I don't know which came first, but there was literally just a week or two between them. Steve Gibson released his Password Haystacks website. Mm-hmm. And the idea in both is hide a human-friendly password in a big haystack. So your defense in length, effectively.
Right.
And so what I did was take the idea of using words from the XKCD comic, the Correct Horse Battery Staple, and kind of use that as a scaffold around which to construct a password that has a little bit more of a broader alphabet, so it's a little harder to guess, a bigger haystack. So if you can imagine, you take the words, you perhaps tag some digits front and back, stick some sort of separator character between all the words, and then maybe tag some padding on the end. And then you have assembled a password that's still human readable, like plus 24 house staple correct 32 exclamation point or something. But it's still human friendly, but it's long and it's safe. And I guess one of the things, I work in IT, and something I have to do a lot is give people passwords to decrypt, say, a securely sent zip file. So I have to email something secretly to someone, I encrypt it, I send it, and then I use the phone, which is an out-of-band communication mechanism, to tell them the password. And if you try that with even a 12-character random password, it's a hell. Uppercase A, lowercase B, exclamation point, plus. But right. If I do a couple of words with a symbol between each word and some digits front and back, they'll love me for it. I've actually had people say, I love your passwords, they're so good. And they're really long and really secure. And so that's kind of the problem to be solved. And I'm a programmer, so I have the luxury of being able to scratch my own itch. So I was able to say, I think someone should do this, and then I was able to say, oh no, actually, I'll just do it.
Right.
And so I did.
Okay. And so then something else that happened, and I guess we should tell everybody. So what this site is it's a tool that uses these concepts to help you build a human readable, memorable password, but one that is also going to be secure.
Yes. And so actually what I actually did first was I wrote an open source library, but that didn't really help very many people. That helped me and it helped programmers, but it didn't help regular people. And so the next thing I did was to build xkpasswd.net as effectively a website to show off what the open source library I released can do.
Right.
So if you want to have, so what I have for myself is I have an automator action in OS 10 that just calls the code and generates a password just like I like them and pops it into my clipboard. So effectively, the Perl library is on GitHub. I think it's BSD license I put it under. So it's like, there are no strings attached. Have some fun. But that wasn't good enough to help enough people. So then I decided to put the web page in front of it so that you have a pointy click interface
for it. Better. Okay.
So I think actually I emailed you to say that the one thing, like everything you said in the last episode was correct and it was all great. And I was listening along going, good, good, great. Then the one thing I think you didn't say that I think is important to say is that human beings are spectacularly bad at being random. Everything we say is coming out of our subconscious, which means it's coming out of the zeitgeist. And when the people are attacking passwords, they're basically using social media to figure out what words are in the mind of humanity. And then they're the only ones they have to check against for passwords. And so what you really need is to take the human equation out and to let a computer, which is unbiased, has no imagination, has no subconscious, let it choose the words.
Okay. So you did not like my idea there. You didn't like my concept of what we've done. And I'm gonna make it even less secure by saying this. Well, I said it already on the show, right? I already made it less secure because I said, you know, my mechanism was using words from the titles of four of my favorite books.
You see, the thing is, that's in dictionaries now. So the attackers are now attacking Bible phrases, film titles, book titles. So they're now being treated as effectively what you're doing in modern attacks is you're using.
Right. But it's one word from each title. So in theory, you know, my theory was, well, they're not connected. Right. And then I'm using the other techniques that you're using in this instance, which is adding some padding, adding some, you know, so there's some additional things in between there. So what I end up with is a really long password, but those words, you know, I get what you're saying about the words. The thing is though, I still have to remember those words, and it's easier for me to remember, oh yeah, it's those words from those favorite books of yours. Right.
What I tend to do, right, so on xkpasswd, you can set it to generate 10 passwords at once. I tend to generate it and then pick one that makes me smile or one that basically one that in some way is a story. So Correct Horse Battery Staple, they're encouraging you to think of a horse thinking, oh, that's correct, it's a horse battery. You know, it's think of a story to put it together, but you put the story in afterwards. So let the computer pick the words and then you fit a story to them that you can remember. And my saying would be, you want one really good password for your 1Password, your LastPass. And then all the rest of them don't have to be stories. They can just be these kind of passwords and put them in the password manager. But that way, if you have to type them in your iPhone or you have to type them in or tell someone over the phone, it's still doable. But you yourself are going to use your password manager 99% of the time.
Right.
That's right. My thinking. I say there's no perfect right answer.
I mean, do you feel that's better than just like, I mean, so I have my 1Password, which was basically built, you know, using a methodology that I just described to you.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'll have to probably change it, but that's a good thing anyway. Because you should
no
do
harm
that.
Every now
you
and then,
do
right?
That periodically. But, you know, I totally get what you're saying, but, you know, I also wonder, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be saying, well, what about the balance? You know, what about, like, is mine really that much less secure than the one generated by your thing, as long as it's got the length and the words aren't, you know, visibly connected together, and we've got the separators in there, we've got the padding.
Yeah, it's the thing I'm always keeping an eye out on. So because I wrote this website, I feel I kind of have a responsibility to people to keep myself in the loop. So I'm always reading about what the guys who are trying to crack it at the moment are putting into their software.
Sure.
And trying to adjust advice based on what the crackers are trying to crack. And right now, anything that's based off a book title or a film title, that is now something they are going after because they know that people take that and then add some fluff to it is a very common technique. And so once something becomes a common technique, they go after it, which is why I think you need to just throw the randomness at it. You take the human element out.
But you see what I'm saying? Where I'm not saying that I picked a book title and then separated the words with separators and numbers. And maybe
okay,
I'm not
so
being clear about that.
Titles. So you're probably better, but the chances are you're probably not using the mundane words, which are more common in the English language.
Right. So I picked 4 different books, right? And 1 word from each title of each book. See how they're... So in my mind,
yes,
that's
yes.
Generating random words that don't have a associative connection with them or shouldn't. I mean,
how
a computer would figure out that those 4 words were connected in this way, I guess the common thread being that they're all from different book titles. But I mean, that seems like you'd have to have a pretty sophisticated piece of software to try and figure that out.
To some extent, of course, the other thing is you don't have to outrun the bear, you just have to outrun enough of your fellow humans. So basically, the way these things work is that someone steals a database of hashed passwords and they have at it. And they'll throw X amount of resources at it and they'll get the weakest 10,000, 100,000 passwords.
Sure.
So if you're not at the bottom of the pile, you're probably fine unless you're the president of the United States or the CEO of a bank, in which case I would say you need to go above and beyond. So you're right. I think for plain old human beings who do not have billions of dollars in their bank account, I think what you're saying is probably right. As long as you don't take a title, as long as you make sure to keep them as separate as possible and not to be afraid of common boring words like these and this. And
right,
you know,
sure. Yeah.
You don't only use interesting words.
Yeah, I didn't keep the boring words, that's for sure. I mean, in getting to your final point, obviously, you know, computer picking the words or your software, you know, like an application like you've written picking the words is going to be much more random and you know, so your point is still taken. It's not lost on me, but I just want to make sure that we're having a clear conversation about, you know, sort of the range of passwords and possibilities.
Good, better, best.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and good is probably good enough.
Well, and I think individuals have to make that choice for themselves too. So,
I know a lot of people who use my site say they actually take fun out of finding the funny ones that it throws at them because it's very meta because it is actually random.
Yeah. But the point is, you know, with my methodology, maybe I'm giving up a little security versus letting the computer pick them, right? But I'm still steps ahead of the person that's using their pet's name. Right.
Many, many steps ahead.
Yeah, right.
Many steps ahead.
No, but I mean, but at the end of the day, too, people are going to have to make a choice and you're going to have to say, you know what, I'm going to use Bart's tool because I want this level of security and that's important to me. Whereas I may make the choice and say, you know what, I liked picking my own words and I did it this way and I think I'm secure enough and I'm comfortable with that and I know what the risks are and... You know what I'm saying? So
absolutely,
security
yeah,
is one of those things everybody has to sort of determine for themselves. But then at the flip side of that is you have to take responsibility for yourself when something happens.
Yes, and which is why I would also say that Steve Gibson's password haystacks is actually quite a good place to pop in a password like the one you're using for real. So don't use your actual password, but use one of the same form.
Right.
And that gives you some idea of how long it would take to crack in a brute force attack. And that can be pleasing sometimes, especially if it's a longer one.
So you just gave me the great transition, because the last sort of thing that I wanted to talk about on this is why the heck, when security guys get together and do this stuff, do they have to talk about, because even the XKCD thing talked about bits of entropy.
Okay, but
and you know what? No one knows what that means.
Okay, but XKCD is a comic for nerds by nerds.
No, but so. I've seen other people referencing it and, you know, describing it, and I think I've even probably been guilty of it myself. Is like, I have no idea what bits of entropy means. So can you help us understand?
Okay.
Or is that too difficult?
Okay, no. Bits of entropy is the amount of work it takes to guess.
There you go.
Okay. So basically, if you have the alphabet is 26 letters. If you take only lowercase letters, then every character has 26 possibilities. So a 2-character password would be 26 multiplied by 26 possibilities. A 3-character password, 26 by 26 by 26. And these numbers get exponential really, really quickly.
Sure.
And to get them back into human size, the conversion from permutations to bits of entropy involves logarithms and these kind of things, which just collapse that exponential scale down to something of a human size.
Right.
And so that's why what you really want is between basically an 8-character password that contains letters, numbers, digits, and symbols is 52 bits of entropy. And as far as I'm concerned, that should be your baseline. And then 78 bits is equivalent to 12 characters of completely random gibberish. And that's sort of a ballpark.
Right.
That's kind of the best I can say. It is just a measure of how much work there is in guessing that password. Okay. That's essentially.
I mean, that simplifies it for people. You know, so the point is more bits of entropy is better, and it basically means it's going to be harder to guess.
Yeah, there's more work for the computer to do if it's trying to guess your password.
Okay. Yep. So do you actually use these passwords for all of your passwords? This sort of
Yes. So I have thing. One password which contains, I think you said yours was a few hundred. Mine is, I think, 600 or something, because I work in IT.
My one password. Mm-hmm. I have over 2,000. I think I have 27.
Okay, yeah, okay. So we're of the 100. Same ilk.
Yeah, I have 2,700 passwords in there.
I have one really long password that is my one password for one password.
Yep.
And then in there, all of my passwords are of this form.
Yeah. I was going to ask you why that versus just letting. I mean, I all mine are just randomly generated by the one password built in.
It's because when I'm traveling or when I'm on someone else's computer, I just bring one password up my iPhone. I pop it up on the screen, and it is so much easier to type 4 words with some symbols and numbers than it is to type 12 actually random characters.
There you go. Oh, and it's even worse for me because mine are all generated at 24 characters.
Yeah. So there's actually a preset on XKPassWD called Apple ID, and that passes all. Apple's rules are really strict. You're not allowed to repeat a character more than twice, so you can't do padding as much as you'd like. So there's kind of strict rules for Apple, but also I chose the symbols for that preset so they are all easily reachable on the iPhone keyboard. Nice. So you never have to go into that second deep keyboard.
Cool.
And also the words are, the cases randomized by word. So the whole word is uppercase. The whole word is lowercase. And so when you're on an iPhone on that little tiny keyboard, those little things matter.
Yep, they certainly do. They certainly do. Well, cool. I think that sort of gets everything that we needed to talk about, right?
Cool. Yeah, so basically for the people who just like to click on buttons, which is, I think, most human beings, xkpasswd.net is where I have that sort of the web interface to my tool. And for the nerds, there's a link there to the GitHub where all the code is, and it's free. It's free, open source. There's a command line tool has just been added to that open source library, so you can do it from the terminal. You can do it. You can invoke all this kind of stuff from OS X services, so you can make it in. You can do all sorts of cool stuff through Automator with it. So all that's there for the nerds on my GitHub.
Cool. So people should check that out. Great way to generate good, secure passwords. And there's some education, too. You've got some great links, like you said, over to the XKCD thing, to password haystacks and all that stuff. So yes. People should check that out. And then also, just tell them about a little bit about yourself and what you do and where they can find your stuff.
Okay, so by day I'm a Linux sysadmin, and by night I like to podcast. So I have two monthly shows because I don't have that much time to podcast. So I do a photography show in the middle of every month. And the idea of that show is that it's not about gear, it's about the art and craft of photography. So it doesn't matter what you're shooting with, what we talk about is of relevance to everyone. And then the other one is an Apple show. And the idea, the niche I tried to fill is, we try to look at the forest instead of the tree. So it's a monthly show at the end of every month to pick up on, to summarize that month's Apple news. So it's 12 shows a year. But as I said, we're trying to be different to all the other shows by not having it be this happened, this happened, this happened. But here's a bigger picture of what June was like or July was like for the Apple world.
Yep. And it's a great show. I'm on every once in a while. And people,
I was just going to say, there's a great guy called Adam Christensen who's kind of give us his time from time to time. And all of those shows are at lets-talk.ie.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Bart.
Well, thank you, Adam. It was fun.
So there you go. You should now have all the tools and information you need to create really secure, really robust passwords. Keep yourself protected. You know, I have always been a big proponent of the whole backup thing. I'm also a big proponent of, you know, more better secure passwords, and any tools that you can use to make those better, I think, are ultimately a good thing. And thanks to Bart again for coming on and giving us more information about that. You want to talk WWDC? You know, we didn't get a chance to talk about WWDC because I was on vacation, and then, you know, I came back and so much stuff was going on. And I'm sure at this point, most of you are fully aware of all the announcements and new features and things like that. So I'm not going to go into all the nitty gritty and stuff like that. But what I figured I would talk to you about is really what I'm most excited about coming out of WWDC and looking forward to. And I'd love to hear what you're excited about and you're looking forward to as well, or maybe even if there were some things you were a little bit disappointed by. I wasn't ultimately disappointed by this WWDC. I think they hit all of the things that I really wanted them to hit, starting off with Snowfall, you know, letting the snow fall, and, you know, doing this little hint back to the Snow Leopard release with the announcement of the name, you know, El Capitan, saying, hey, we're going to stay in Yosemite and we're just going to have, you know, we're going to sprinkle a little snow in there, meaning, and what most of us take that to mean, is focusing on performance and stability enhancements, that being the key focus. We're not going to get a lot of massive new whiz-bang features, not a lot of big UI stuff. That doesn't mean we're not going to get anything, because there's some really great stuff in here, as you're going to hear here in a second, but I was most excited about that. I think that was number one. It was like, okay, this is exactly what we want. The other thing was proactive Siri, a Siri that is smarter, a Siri that's going to know more about me. This was something that I discussed in the run-up, I think, to the release of iOS 8 as one of my desires for Siri. You know, I want Siri to be smarter about me, knowing where I am, what I'm about to do, when I'm doing it. And all this stuff is what Apple is collectively calling intelligence. But it amounts to knowing and acting on the information that is already existing there in my phone and being smart about how they're using it. So one feature I don't think, and I haven't seen this demoed, and I really would want in there, but I think that exemplifies this, is I'm constantly annoyed that I want to be able to tell Siri or ask Siri to give me driving directions to my next appointment. I should be able to say, Siri, can I have driving directions to my next appointment? And she should happily, because I have that appointment in my calendar. I've probably had a couple emails about it where we've gone back and forth talking about appointment times and schedules. She should know, oh, hey, look, you've got an appointment coming up in 30 minutes. That's probably the one you want directions for, right? And be able to just do that for me. That's not working right now. But she supposedly will be able to warn me if there's going to be traffic delays in coming up with my next appointment that's coming up and prompt me to, you know, on when to leave the house. So I have to imagine that kind of feature's in there. But one of the reasons that was often cited for Apple not implementing or making Siri smarter was privacy. But Apple is doing exactly what I pointed out that they could do, which is tap into the local information that's right there on the phone. They don't have to go out to the cloud. They don't have to sync any of this information. It doesn't have to be done on server. It's already in there. And they give a great demo of this during the WWDC keynote, which was you have an incoming call from Siri. It checks your contact records to see if it knows who that is, and if you have them in your address book, it displays that for you. But now it can also parse through and index through your emails and look at those. And search locally at those emails and say, you know, I think this might be so-and-so, because guess what? They had that phone number in their signature. And so I think that is really, really great. And then one other feature that I read about with Siri that I'm excited about is you can now put Siri, give Siri an accent. Your language choice and your Siri's voice language choice are going to be two distinct preferences in iOS 9. So they're not going to be, they're going to no longer be tied together. Because the problem is, while I could have Australian Siri, suddenly all of my Siri information and stuff was coming out of Australia, right? So now you can actually have a different accent with your Siri. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a minor thing, but, you know, it's kind of a big deal. The other thing I'm excited about is more data in Spotlight. Spotlight being better, smarter, exposing more information without me having to open up an application. Developers are going to have the ability to expose content within their apps to the iOS 9 search index so they can make information available, and then Spotlight will be able to what Apple's calling deep linking, deep link into that app data without actually having to launch the app. So it can present it there right in the Spotlight search results. And if I need to go even deeper, I can dig into the application, or they have this cool little back button now that'll allow me to sort of jump back out of that deep linked data. So I'm looking forward to that. The split view, slide over keyboard enhancements, these are things that are coming to the iPad that I think are really going to make the iPad come into its own. I know a lot of people have been championing and saying, you know, Apple needs to be able to do multiple windows and stuff like that. The thing was, is I never really saw it implemented in a very elegant way or in a way that made sense for a tablet. And I think Apple's taking their time to kind of focus on multitasking and do it in a way that makes sense for tablets, both older ones and new ones. I think we saw that come to fruition at this WWDC. So, you know, the ability to do slide over and split screen looks really, really great. And I'm excited about that. I'm even more excited, though, about the keyboard gestures, the ability to do selections on the keyboard, because in my opinion, they're totally broken in the current implementation. Those little handles, do you have trouble accessing those and getting those into the right place? They don't always make the selection correct. You know, the ability to do that with more like mouse-like precision using the area of the keyboard as a trackpad, I think is an excellent implementation, and I'm looking forward to playing around with that. Another thing that I'm very excited about, and you wouldn't think so being in the US, is Apple Pay in the UK. Finally, maybe. I think Apple said they're going to be rolling it out in July, if I'm remembering right. With about 70% of the banks in the UK supported, 250,000 locations accepting Apple Pay, including the London Underground, which I think is great. The thing is that something they didn't talk about is currently in the UK, there is a £20 limit on contactless payments, and Apple Pay is going to be subject to that. I guess they're going to raise the limit in the fall to about £30. But the rumor is long term that some retailers may be able to actually remove the limit entirely. That's not going to be happening at launch. So it's sounding like at launch, you still are going to be subject to those limits. But Apple did post information on what they're calling their consumer device cardholder verification method, CDCVM. And in there, it sort of details the technologies and information that would enable you to get past this. I guess what's happening is this is going to require updated terminals and things like that. So that's going to slow the rollout of being able to have retailers that will be able to opt out of these retail limits. And the reason these things need to be in place, I guess, is because it will shift the liability from the merchant and the card terminal if there is fraud over to the card issuing bank. And then the other thing that was noted in this article is that CDCVM is not supported over PIN debit networks. So if your bank happens to be using a PIN debit network or your card's tied into a PIN debit network, I guess you'll never be able to implement this new form of fraud protection that Apple requires to get past this payment limit. So you will have that at rollout, but, you know, Apple Pay in the UK, I think that's great. And the reason I'm excited about it is because the more places that get Apple Pay, the more people that are using and demanding Apple Pay, the faster Apple Pay adoption will happen. And I absolutely love Apple Pay. If you ever get a chance to use it, and I guess if you're in the UK, you will soon, you're going to love it. It is awesome, awesome stuff. The news application, I'm throwing this in here because, you know, I do a podcast, I work with blogs, I'm excited about the news application, but tentatively, you know, Apple has tried to get into the news business with Newsstand, with RSS and Safari, and so far the implementations haven't been that great. Now, news looks great in terms of presenting RSS feeds and information in a really beautiful way. I think really, though, news's success will depend on the content providers sort of adopting it, because it looks like there's some enhanced features, some things that you can build in there that make the experience even better and would make people more apt or want to use the news application versus other RSS aggregator apps like Flipboard or some of the other ones that are out there. And I think that's going to be key into it being a really awesome service. So if, you know, my favorite providers of content sort of buy into the news platform, then I think it's going to be great. If that doesn't happen, I don't know that, you know, it's really going to take off that well. So tentatively excited about news. I'm excited about more Android support. Another thing that might shock you. Apple Music coming to Android in the fall. So it's not going to be there out of the gate on 30th, but it is going to be there. The one limit I'm hearing about on the Android side is, I guess there's some free features or functionality that the Android app might not have access to. It's not really clear what those features are, but something that is being talked about. But also on the Android side, Apple released a Move to iOS app to help switchers. So this is a thing, if you are using an Android device and you want to move over to an iOS device, it will transfer your contacts, your message history, photos, videos, web bookmarks, mail accounts, calendars, even your wallpapers. So a lot of your data, I think it will even transfer non-DRM'd media content. Of course, DRM content is not going to be transferred. It will need to be repurchased. And then apps. It will actually analyze your free apps and attempt to rebuild your catalog with the iOS versions of those apps if they're available. And then for paid apps, it will actually put together an iOS wish list. So you'll have to rebuy any of your paid applications, of course, because they're not cross-platform. But other than that, it's going to make transitioning from Android over to iOS really, really easy. And I think that's really cool. And hopefully Apple keeps, you know, continuing to bring more and more support, cross-platform support to iOS. I mean, could you imagine if we get AirDrop for Android and we can exchange files back and forth via AirDrop? That would be cool, right? I'm also very excited about enhancements to Spotlight, specifically natural language searching in Spotlight. So to be able to just type naturally and have my search results come up. You know, I did my Pismo Beach vacation. It's going to be awesome to say, show me Pismo Beach vacation photos from last year. Just type that into a Spotlight search and boom, everything comes up. Or I need those PDF files from last week, and they just magically show up in Spotlight. So Apple is tapping metadata in better and more creative ways, and I'm excited to see how that all works. And also Spotlight searching inside Apple's built-in applications. So you're going to be able to do the same kinds of searches, say, inside Mail. So show me all my emails with attachments from last week that came from Larry. You know, those sorts of things. Just type out what you want to see, and boom, it's going to return those results. And then the last big announcement I already talked about coming out of WWDC, native watch applications. You know, again, because let's face it, current watch apps are a stopgap measure. They're all right, but they're really not all that great. So I'm looking forward to little better apps on my Apple Watch. A few honorable mentions that I just want to point out. The window management in OS X El Capitan, the, you know, side-by-side view and split view stuff there, picture-in-picture videos on your iPad. I'm not sure how useful that's going to be for me, but it looks cool and interesting. We'll see if that's something that really makes a difference. Transit in Maps. I don't use a lot of transit stuff but for people who do, you know, that's been a long time coming, so it's great to see that making its way in there. Enhancements to the caps lock mode on the iOS keyboard. Thank God, because I can never figure that thing out. It's now going to show lowercase letters when you're not shifted and uppercase letters when it's shifted. Some people don't like that, but it sounds like you're going to be able to control that feature, turn it on or off. Control which device rings and gets messages in continuity. So you don't have to have every device ringing when you get a phone call. You can control that per device. That's huge. Passbook being renamed to Wallet and getting support for store credit cards and loyalty cards. That's good. It also makes more sense for that to just be more generically called Wallet. So I like the renaming. And Metal in OS X. Specifically for me, not so much for gaming, although it's going to be an amazing thing for gaming. The native UI and animation improvements. Just better performance, better battery life with the day-to-day things that are happening visually on the Mac. So that's it. Things that I'm excited about coming out of WWDC. What did I miss? Did I miss something? They did mention a little bit about HomeKit and Apple TV, but I think they could have done more on that. Other than that, I think that's it. It was a great WWDC. What are you excited about? What really got you going? Send me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Are you excited about Apple Music? I mean, we are just days away. I'm recording this on the 24th. Apple Music hits, 100 countries, although I don't know if Apple specifically spelled out the 100 countries on the 30th. It's going to be a lot of places, but, there's a lot of questions about, how is it going to work? What does it look like? We know what's in there because at WWDC, Jimmy Iovine outlined sort of the three pillars of Apple Music. You've got the revolutionary music streaming service, the 24/7 global radio station in Beats One, and then the whole Kinect stuff where artists can connect with their fans through social media kind of things with posting lyrics and unreleased songs and all that sort of stuff. It seems amazing, but, what's going to go on once we are actually able to tap into it? Well, I already mentioned that you're going to be able to get access on June 30th in 100 countries to Apple Music from your iPhone, your iPad, iPod Touches, Macs, and PCs. So even our Windows friends, it is coming to Android and also Apple TV in the fall, and it will be able to pair up with your Apple Watch. In case you missed pricing is going to be $9.99 a month or $14.99 a month for a family plan, and that's up to 6 members in your family. And there's also the 3-month free trial, which I think we've covered extensively at this point. And what's cool is family accounts are independent, so you're going to have your own music, your own playlists, all for that $14.99 price. So it seems like a pretty good deal to me. There are also going to be some features that are free for anyone. So you're going to have the radio stations that are in there, including the new Beats One radio. Those will be ad supported at the free tier. The radio is going to have additional curated stations as well as the ability to create your own station. So this really sounds like a rebranding of iTunes Radio as we have it right now. And with the free versions, you will be able to skip tracks up to 6 per hour. If you're paid, you don't have a limit on that, and you don't get the ads in the radio service. But those are going to be free for anyone who wants to use them through Apple Music. Of course, you have the streaming service in there, and that is going to give you access to all of the music that is in the Apple Music catalog. Also access to any of your iTunes purchased music and ripped CDs that are in your iTunes library. So those will actually get uploaded. As far as what's in the Apple Music library, Apple is only saying that it's tens of millions of songs. So it's clear it's not the entire iTunes store library, but it is a significant portion of it. And I have to imagine that has to just do with Apple securing the rights. And, this indie label deal that they just did is going to bring a lot more music into the library. So that is a good thing. But you're probably noticing right now as I'm naming out these features, it seems like a lot of these features are also part of iTunes Match. And so the question becomes, does it replace or supersede iTunes Match? Apple's claiming that iTunes Match is actually an independent but complementary service. And in my mind, it seems like that might be the case if you stick with just the free Apple Music features and you still want to have some of the features of, you know, being able to upload your library and have that matched and be able to pull that down. The one key difference I think that I see is with Apple Music, it's not clear that you'd be able to actually re-download music tracks that were matched from your library. So if you've ripped a bunch of CDs and you want to sort of upgrade those to the Apple versions, I don't think you're going to be able to pull those down. Now, Apple Music will let you download music to sort of listen to offline, but I don't think you technically own or get to keep copies of those, especially, you know, past if you, you know, cancel out of the service. So it is a true streaming music service in that sense. And so maybe that's why Apple still sees iTunes Match as a complimentary service. But you will be able to, you know, use Apple Music. It's going to, the streaming service, it's going to build a profile of your music tastes. When you first fire it up, it's going to ask you about the kinds of music you want, try to make recommendations. Those recommendations are going to be a mix of computer algorithms and also human curation. So it's going to be a little bit of both. And then the quality of the streams, that sort of got called into question this week. Apple is going to be streaming 250 kilobit per second audio. Most of us assume it's going to be in the AAC format. And several outlets have commented that this is below the 320 kilobits per second that some of the other streaming services are streaming, services like Spotify. But those services use the MP3 format. And the AAC format can actually achieve higher quality audio at lower bit rates. So I don't think there's going to be any quality difference versus some of the other competitors that are out there. I think most people aren't going to be able to tell the difference. And bottom line is, at a lower bit rate, that's going to be better for bandwidth. So if you know, worried about the strain on your mobile plan, lower bit rate is actually better for you, especially if you can't hear any perceivable difference in the audio quality. So that's the streaming part. Then you've got the Beats Radio, Beats Radio 1, and the other stations that are in there. It does seem like iTunes Radio rolled into and being combined with Apple Music Radio, and you will be able to listen to Apple's preset stations or create your own based on artist, song, album, genre, etc. So looking forward to being able to try that out. And then finally, you've got the Connect features. That's where you can follow and connect with your favorite artists. Any artist can actually go in and claim their Apple Music profile and then get set up to actually be able to post content. And like I said, they'll be able to post videos, audio, text, images, lyrics. Fans will be able to comment on the posts, and the artist can actually respond directly in Apple Music. And they're also going to have the ability to cross-post to Twitter and Facebook. And I think that's really key to getting artists to use the service. So Apple's really trying to build it as one place they can go to connect with their fans, not just on Apple Music, but also on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media services. And hopefully they'll continue to expand those features out as they get more feedback from artists and see what they need and what they want in terms of connecting with their fans. And so that's kind of the service in the nutshell. The only other thing, I guess, that remains is if you're already on Beats, you know, where does it fit in for you? Apple is going to continue to run Beats, so you could stay on Beats. But after, I guess, they launch the service, when you first go into the Beats application, it's going to recommend that you migrate over to the Apple Music service. And they're going to be promoting that pretty heavily. They'll do the same thing for Android subscribers when the service becomes available on that platform. But if you do choose to migrate, it will be able to move all of the albums that you've saved, all of the playlists and things, and sync that over to the Apple Music service. And you can even keep your Beats username as you move over to Apple Music. So they're really trying to make that whole process seamless. And if you're looking at Apple Music, you can certainly see it shares a lot of code, I think, or a lot of at least roots with the Beats Music application. The whole onboarding process, you know, the process you go through when you first set up the application, looks identical to what I went through when I did my Beats trial a while back. So looking forward to getting on to Apple Music, and we'll see how the service goes. But so far, I think it's getting a pretty positive buzz, and I look forward to using it. So SSDs, I think, you know, if you've been listening to the show, I took a while to come over to the SSD camp in terms of a speed performance improvement for an older Mac. But now that I've done it, you know, I'm firmly in the camp of, if you can afford an SSD and can put one in your Mac, especially if you have an older model that's, you know, showing signs of its age, it can give your Mac a whole new life. I think it's a really, really great upgrade. But, you know, not all of us are maybe comfortable opening up our Macs. And so I received this comment from, or question really, from Dan.
Hi, Adam. This is Dan calling from Brookfield, Wisconsin. I love your show. Been listening for a long time. And I recommend it to all of my Mac friends. In fact, all of my PC friends as well. Really have enjoyed it over the years. Great advice, great information and news. I have a question for you. I have an iMac that's probably about 2 years old. It has the first generation Thunderbolt connections in the back of it. And, you know, it's just so difficult to take those darn things apart that I'm wondering if I could do a poor man's SSD. Right now I have a 1 terabyte internal drive in it, and I'm thinking, is it possible, or I'm sure it's possible, but is it worth it to do an SSD externally with a Thunderbolt connection and boot from that? Is that going to give me additional speed and have my apps and some essentials on that SSD? And then have the rest of my data on a hard drive internally. Is that worth it speed-wise, or is it really just going to be a big headache? I think I can manage the boot information in terms of booting off of the SSD, but I just don't know speed-wise. Is it going to be worth it for me to do like a poor man's internal drive, external drive, type of upgrade instead of just getting a whole new internal drive put in for quite a bit of money? I appreciate it. And I'll continue listening. I really enjoy your stuff. Keep it up. Have a great vacation. Bye.
Hey, Dan. Great. Thanks for the question. I think it's a really good one and probably something a lot of us have wondered about. And I wasn't really sure at first. My first guess was that this would work fine just looking at the numbers. You know, looking at the numbers, it seems like it would be something that would give you a slight performance boost versus going internal. But I think internal is still the better way to go. And let me explain why. Looking at external SSDs, it seems like you have random read-write times of about 100 to 200 megabits per second, somewhere in that range. You know, when you're doing sequential writes, read-writes and things like that, you're going to get much better performance. But we're talking about something that's going to be your boot volume, right? So it's going to be jumping around the drive. It's going to be doing a lot of things. But here's the thing is that external SSDs are pretty pricey when you compare them on a pure, you know, cost per you know, gigabyte basis with the internal drives, especially because you're probably going to get that kind of performance, you're going to want one that's probably a Thunderbolt external SSD drive. And those things are pretty pricey. I looked at the ones from Lissy. You can get about a 256 drive for about 256 gigabyte drive, rather, for about $300. The Elgato one, 256 gigabytes, is $379. Again, these are the Thunderbolt drives. You could possibly do USB 3. That's going to drop the price down. OWC had one, a 240 gigabyte one, for about $150. But in real-world testing, the sustained transfer speed of a USB 3 drive tops out at about 110 megabits per second. So you're losing a little bit of performance on the USB 3 side. And so you're going to get way better performance, less cable mess, and I think better resale value on your iMac if you consider upgrading to an internal. Because right now, it looks like you can get really good 250 gigabyte internal SSD on Amazon for about $100. So almost a third of the cost if you're going with Thunderbolt, $50 less if you were going to go to USB 2. And then what I would do is I'd contact your local Apple authorized, you know, repair center or reseller and see what they can install it for. I called around and I could get an install for about $150 to $200. So at that point, you're about the same price as a external Thunderbolt SSD drive. You're in the range, and you don't have to do the work yourself. You can get it installed professionally, get it done well, And I think it's going to be better for you all around, both in terms of performance and just in cost. And of course, if you're brave enough to do it yourself, you can get all the tools you need and find great instructions on how to do it using a site like ifixit.com. So it's really, you know, it looks daunting. I know people have done it. I don't know if I would do an iMac with how they're sort of set up. I'm kind of with you on that. I'd probably just pay to have my my local Apple authorized repair center kind of put that thing in for me. But call around, you know, do a little more research on this. I think you'll find that it's really not maybe as costly as you're thinking it might be, especially when you consider the cost difference between, you know, a really nice Thunderbolt external SSD versus just, you know, buying the bare SSD internal drive. Normally, I'm not really big on gestures. I know a lot of people who are like trackpad wizards who use all of the different gestures and stuff like that. I'm a Magic Mouse user mostly when I'm sitting at my desk. When I'm out and about, I often forget about gestures and stuff like that. But I ran across this article over at iMore where they found a cool hidden gesture in the OS X dock. And I know this works in Yosemite. I'm not sure how far back it goes. And it's great if you have a Magic Mouse trackpad or a Magic trackpad, and you want a way to quickly see all of the open windows that are in an application. So by entering this terminal command, and I'll put the full terminal command in the show notes at maccast.com, but you can enter this little command in the terminal and it will turn on this hidden feature so that when you swipe up on the dock icon of an application, it will display all the windows that are currently open for that application. So if you're using a Magic Mouse, you swipe up with one finger on the icon in the dock. If you're using a trackpad, it's two fingers. And it's just one of these quick, you know, document defaults write commands, and it suddenly you've enabled the scroll to open dock feature. And I think this is one that actually might prove to be useful for me, because I'm often, and especially just when I'm working on the laptop itself, you've got all your windows layered on top of each other. You want to quickly see, okay, what's open, you know, what windows are open for this application, what I leave open, close things up and stuff like that. So, well, time will tell if I continue to use this, but I still thought it was a cool little trick and worth pointing out. I have one other thing to get to before we get to our thing of the moment, and that is a question from Kenny about taking audio calls on the Mac.
Hi, Adam. It's Kenny calling from O'Fallon, Illinois. Very big fan of the podcast and appreciate what you do. I had a question about making phone calls from my Mac. Since I got Yosemite and iOS 8, I really enjoy the capability of answering and making phone calls from my Mac that are coming in through my phone. My problem has to do with sound input and output. Day-to-day, sound from my Mac comes out of speakers, and the input is my camera mounted on top of the monitor. But this doesn't work well for phone calls. I have to be very close to the microphone to make it people hear me clearly. What I'd like is when a phone call comes in, for a way to manage sound through the FaceTime calls so that I can have a USB headset hooked up. And when I make a phone call, the sound automatically gets routed through the headset, and the rest of the sounds will stay through the computer speakers and microphone. So I was wondering if you know of any utilities to help me do that, or any settings in the Mac that take care of sounds just for those phone calls. I appreciate it. Look forward to hearing back. Thanks.
Hey, Kenny. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a utility or any cool trick for doing that. The first thing that came to mind for me was, you know, using the speaker, you know, the input, the volume menu bar item, where if you hold down the Option key and you click on that, you can quickly change input between your output devices and your input devices. So, you know, you could answer the call on your Mac and then quickly just go up to the menu bar as you're sort of onboarding or starting up the call and quickly switch those inputs back and forth using that kind of shortcut. The only other thing that I came up with when I was looking around for possible answers to this is a option maybe of using an accessibility option that is available on the iPhone. On the iPhone, if you go into settings under general accessibility and then scroll down to the interaction section, there is a setting called call audio routing. And the description for it says call audio routing determines where sound will be heard during a phone call or FaceTime audio. And then your choices are automatic, speaker, or headset. So I would imagine that you can change this to headset, but the problem here is that I believe it would only work if you had your headset paired with your iPhone. And I'm assuming with what you're talking about here, your headset is paired with your computer, but you might try pairing it with the iPhone instead and then playing around with the setting and then see where the call audio is routed. I don't know if that would be picked up or passed through your computer, because when you're taking a FaceTime call, the call is actually being routed through your phone. But I think still in terms of where the audio input is, it's still coming from your Mac. So I don't think that's going to work for you, but you may still be able to use this because maybe you can pick up the call again on the Mac, and then it's pretty easy to transfer it to the iPhone. You just look over at the iPhone, you'll see the little green bar on the top, and when you tap that, it will give you the option to pull that call over the iPhone. So maybe you could still pick it up, set up the auto pairing settings so that it always uses the headset for FaceTime and phone calls on your iOS device, and maybe handle it that way. That was about the best I could come up with on this one. Maybe someone in our community has a better idea, and if you do, you have a better answer for Kenny, and you found a tool or utility that will do what he wants on the Mac, please email me, maccast@gmail.com, and I'll try and share that on a future episode. All right, let's talk thing of the moment. I have a pretty straightforward, simple, short one for you today. I had to get a new pair of studio headphones for doing the podcast with. I have been using a set of Shure headphones for a really long time, and basically the ear cups just completely disintegrated. So I was looking around for new ones, and I ran across the Audio-Technica ATH M40X Professional Studio Monitoring Headphone or Monitor Headphones. I know, not the sexiest of names, but a really nice pair of studio headphones. They're $99 on Amazon. They're a closed over-the-ear design. They have really nice, comfortable ear pads on them. They sound great. A little more bass than my prior headphones, but I actually kind of like that. And the key with these is they were the only ones I could find at this $99 price point that offered a replaceable cord. Because very often what happens with headphones is it's the cord or the cord connectors that go out. So I liked having the ability to just swap that out. So it, the cord plugs right into the headphones on one end and then into your headphone jack on the other end. So you can totally replace that. And it was really the only one at this price point that I could find. And so far I'm loving these headphones. I think they sound great. They look great. They're nice build quality, great price point. So check them out. Audio Technica ATH M40X. And that is our thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Make sure you check out PDF Pen Pro 7. Also check out PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of Smile Software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies. With their easy-to-follow video tutorials, you can get a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, I welcome your audio comments as well as your emails to maccast@gmail.com. If you'd prefer to leave a voicemail message, you can just call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you use Skype, you can also leave voicemail there. My Skype username is the MacCast. Just call on there and leave your voicemail there. It's really quick and easy, and you save on long distance charges, so that's a good deal. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, the internets, and you want to follow me there, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also, you can check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find us on Google Plus. That's google.com/PlusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol, not spelled out. So plus symbol, MacCast on Google Plus, and I look forward to seeing you there. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.